Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. Today I'll be talking with young San Francisco cellist Oliver Herbert, who makes his subscription debut with the San Francisco Symphony playing music of Haydn in a program that combines the classical and the neoclassical, with conductor Michael Tilson Thomas rounding out the program with music of Stravinsky. From the New Century Chamber Orchestra, I'll talk with music director and concertmaster Daniel Hope to discuss the ensemble's new season, which opens this weekend. I'll also talk with actors Kathleen Ridley and Victor Talmadge, as well as artistic director Michael Morin from the Ubuntu Theater Project in Oakland. The ensemble presents Eugene O'Neill's Tony and Pulitzer Prize-winning drama Long Day's Journey into Night. Also, Open Air's regular contributor and critic-at-large, Peter Robinson, pays homage to Ken Burns' PBS series on country music and gives us a preview of the 42nd annual Mill Valley Film Festival. Stay with us. New Century Chamber Orchestra opens its 2019-20 season this weekend with a program entitled Fin de Siècle, featuring works written at the turn of the 19th century. Teenage piano sensation Maxime Landau makes his New Century debut performing alongside music director and concertmaster Daniel Hope, who joins me in studio. They'll be collaborating for a string orchestra arrangement of Chausson's Concert for Violin, Piano, and String Quartet. Also on the program, Greek violinist Simos Papanas, a longtime collaborator of Daniel's, makes his debut leading the ensemble as guest concertmaster. The program includes Edward Elgar's Introduction and Allegro, as well as music by Jules Massenet, Arnold Schoenberg, and Christian Sinding. The NCCO welcomed virtuoso violinist Daniel Hope as artistic partner in the 2017-18 season. He's celebrated for his musical versatility as well as his dedication to humanitarian causes. In addition to his duties with the New Century, Daniel serves as music director of the Zurich Chamber Orchestra and associate artistic director of the Savannah Music Festival. Daniel is one of the world's most prolific classical recording artists, with over 25 albums to his name, including his recording of Max Richter's Vivaldi Recomposed, which is one of the most successful classical recordings of recent years. He's also penned 4 best-selling books in Germany, contributes regularly to the Wall Street Journal, and presents a weekly radio show for the WDR3 channel. Daniel Hope, I should defer to you for maybe hosting your own interview.
Oh, I think that's not necessary, but it's great to be here.
Well, let's start with that. You do a weekly radio program. You're saying you do 50 programs a week, yes. A year in Germany.
That's right, yeah. Right. It's a great privilege for me to get to do this. 2 hours dedicated to music, telling stories about music and compositions. I pick a theme every Sunday, and we have a lot of music, but also a lot of stories, and try and illustrate a little bit about how these great works came to pass. And the great thing with themes is that you can mix up the music, so we literally have from Renaissance to contemporary in every edition.
And a free hand, I hope, in terms of what you can program.
Completely free.
That's lovely. It's a rarity in radio.
It is.
Kind of have that luxury as well. Try not to take advantage of it, but it's a nice thing to have.
Yes.
Now, this is your third season involved with the NCCO, one of only a handful of conductorless chamber ensembles in the world. How's it going? I mean, do you like that format preferable to having a tyrant on the podium?
I have to admit, I love it. I love working with this orchestra and these ensemble. These players are so full of energy and so devoted to making music, chamber music on a grand scale. And that's what happens when you remove the conductor. Nothing against conductors, of course. But there's something very special in the dynamic that bounces between the musicians, and that I felt from the very first moment that we played together, and we're working on that and increasing it. We did our first European tour this year, 12 concerts around Germany and Poland, which was a huge success, and here in the Bay Area we just love coming up with new programs and reaching out to the community here.
Mm-hmm. Which brings us to coming up with this program, Siècle. Siècle, but the... I'm trying to think of the French for 19th.
19e.
19e siècle.
Yeah, the turn of the century. I mean, this is a period of history which has always fascinated me in music, in art, in politics, in literature. And I thought it would be great to bring these elements together, to tell the story of, you know, what kind of music was out there between the 1890s and, let's say, 1905. So it's an exploration of composers, some of whom were looking back into the 19th century, some were looking forward. And for example, we have Arnold Schoenberg, but not as you would expect necessarily to hear him. Mm. Very romantic, very tonal. Mm. But at the same time, Edward Elgar, we have this Chausson extraordinary concerto, which we're playing with this brilliant young pianist. So it's a concert full of emotion, beautiful music, and lots of energy.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the Schoenberg, and it's not something that people should be frightened about. The beautiful early Schoenberg, well, a lot of his late music, of course, is beautiful as well in a different way. But this particular Notturna for strings and harp, tell us about that work.
This is indeed a very early work, which comes from that kind of tone poem time of his, where he was really examining melody, and yet it was much closer to Mahler and Strauss. It's absolutely gorgeous. I would say it's a masterpiece, but it's hardly ever played, so I'm thrilled we're getting to do it here.
Well, let's give it a little radio play then. In the Notturno of for strings and harp by Arnold Schoenberg, which will be performed tonight at the First Congregational Church in Berkeley, Saturday here in San Francisco, and Sunday in San Rafael. After a little taste of Schoenberg, more with Daniel Hope.
Thank you.
beautiful excerpt from the Notturno for Strings and Harp by Arnold Schoenberg from around 1895 or so. Wonderful to include that work and to have a different taste of Schoenberg on the program.
Yeah, it's just magnificent, and it fits in with some of the other pieces that we have stylistically. Richard Strauss, we have the song Morgan, one of the most beautiful songs probably ever written, but also Chausson, Elgar. It's all this feeling of kind of decadence that we sometimes associate with turn of the century.
Mm-hmm. And tell us how you came across the 16-year-old pianist Maxime Landau.
I met him when he was the ripe old age of 14 in Germany. We were put together in a festival for young musicians. I'm not young, of course, but I was there as the kind of mentor, I guess. And we just from the first second I heard him, I was just knocked out. He was a most extraordinary talent. He really is a complete musician, and that doesn't happen very often with very, very talented youngsters. You know,
you don't really want to hear a 16-year-old play Brahms.
No, exactly. And from the first moment, I realized this was somebody very, very special. And so I invited him here to New Century. And in fact, it's his first, not only his debut in California, it's the first time he's ever been to California. So he's incredibly excited, as we are too.
Nice, nice. You're also collaborating with Simos Papanas. Tell us about Simos.
Simos is an extraordinary virtuoso violinist, somebody that's as at home with the Baroque world as he is with the modern violin. He's also a double major in math from Yale University. He's a truly extraordinary individual, and I've worked with him for the last 10 years around the world on various projects. And I wanted New Century to have the chance to also meet some of my collaborating partners, to exchange ideas, to get new impulses, and to look at what's possible sound-wise.
And he's doing the beautiful Elgar introduction and Allegro as both concertmaster and leading the group.
Yes.
And the Chanson du Matin, which I'm not familiar with.
That's a gorgeous piece by Edward Elgar. There are two major pieces of Elgar. I call it major. It's a short piece, but it's very, very beautiful. And it's kind of a swan song for England, which I guess might be rather appropriate at the moment.
Indeed. How are you feeling about the whole
thing? Terribly depressed, what can I say? Yeah. It's the world has gone crazy, but especially in England and this whole Brexit mess. It's so unnecessary.
Mm-hmm. And I've had guests on the past several weeks that have been Brits, and it's affecting the artistic community in some really unforeseen ways that we'll yet to have.
Absolutely. I think nobody really knows what's in store. But at a time where we should be looking for unity and for dialogue, it seems to be the contrary. It's really very, very worrying.
Hmm. Let's see what that unfolds in the days and weeks ahead. We'll hear some Chausson in just a moment, but let's get a little taste of the rest of the NCCO season.
We have the great singer Anna-Sophie von Otter coming here. We're going to do Christmas concerts together, where she'll go from Baroque music through to Frank Sinatra and Duke Ellington, so it'll be a wonderful mix. Then next year, in January, we have Lynn Harrell coming together with Simone Dinnerstein. We're going to play the Triple Concerto, also the First Symphony of Beethoven, the first time NCCO has approached Beethoven symphonies, which I thought in Beethoven year was a good place to start.
Sure.
With the First Symphony, of course. Mm-hmm. Simone Dinnerstein is also coming back. She's a great favorite here with the orchestra and the audiences with a Bach program. So there's a lot to look forward to.
And I believe you're collaborating with the Violins of Hope as well?
That's right.
No relation?
No relation, but an extraordinary project together with the Cole Mansion. There's going to be concerts and a new piece by Jake Heggie that he's written for us with
Jake
Sasha Cook,
about that the other day.
Which looks to examine the story of these violins and, of course, the story of the Holocaust, but done through the idiom of music.
Just to let people know what those Violins of Hope are, these are instruments that were actually owned by or played by victims of the Holocaust or their survivors.
Exactly, and through Amon Weinstein, a violin maker from Israel, he's traced them, he's restored them, traced them, and then given them life again, and they are played then by musicians around the world to share that story, and we'll be some of those musicians as the project comes to the Bay Area in January and February.
Mm. We'll have Jake on again to talk about his wonderful piece. He was on a few months ago talking about it, and is very much looking forward to the collaboration, of course, with Sasha Cook as well.
Oh, we are too.
We did mention that this Fin de Siècle program has such a wealth of material on it. Tell us a little bit about, for those that may not be familiar with Chausson.
Chausson is really, I would still say, an undiscovered master. He died tragically young, most banal way. He was on a bike and he crashed into a wall and died in his late 30s. What a waste. He left only 40 pieces, of which almost all of them are.
It was left in 40 pieces.
Probably. You said that, not me. but he left this concerto, which is originally for violin, piano, and string quartet. And often he orchestrated his works. And so we've taken the liberty of doing the same thing and turning the string quartet part into an entire orchestra. So it becomes a double concerto for these two instruments. And Maxime Lando and I will be joining NCCO to play this piece, and it's amazing. It's just full of the most beautiful melodies. It's about a 45-minute piece. It's a real romp, and just a joy to play.
Let's hear a little bit of the end of it. Thank you so much for coming in, Daniel. We'll have you in again as the season progresses.
Thanks so much.
Daniel Hope, Artistic Director and Concertmaster of the New Century Chamber Orchestra. Their concerts tonight at the First Congregational Church in Berkeley, tomorrow at the Herbst Theater in San Francisco, and Sunday at the Osher Marin JCC in San Rafael. They will be performing at the new Presidio Theater later on in their season. Check out ncco.org for all information on that. Music of Chausson as we continue with Open Air. Lovely music indeed by Ernest Chausson, chosen as part of the New Century Chamber Orchestra's opening concerts, Fin de Siècle. Also on the program, music of Edward Elgar, Christian Sinding, Jules Massenet, the incredible Meditation from Thais, some Schoenberg, as we heard earlier, a Notturno for strings and harp, and Richard Strauss's Morgen for violin and strings. Daniel Hope and the members of the NCCO, ncco.org. for more information. More music this hour as well. I'll be talking with Oliver Herbert, who's the young guest solo cellist for the San Francisco Symphony Concerts this week, and music of Haydn in a program that also includes a healthy helping of neoclassical music of Stravinsky, the program imagined by Michael Tilson Thomas, who will be on the podium. Well, next, continuing its tradition of reimagining classical dramas for a contemporary America, Ubuntu Theater Project is excited to present a new production of Eugene O'Neill's Long Day's Journey Into Night, October 4th through the 27th in Oakland. I'm here with the artistic director of the company, Michael Morin, and he is going to be joined by Kathleen Ridley, a multiple award-winning Bay Area actor and a company member with Shotgun Players, Theater First, and Playground. She's also been a prominent presence in productions at Marin Theater, Central Works, Theater Works, among her many works, and was Aldonza in the memorable production of Man of La Mancha at SF Playhouse. Nice work on that, Kathleen. She's working with Ubuntu for the first time, playing the role of Mary Tyrone. Welcome, Kathleen.
Thank you very much.
Of course. Michael Moran joins us in studio to tell us a little bit about the mission of Ubuntu and his many initiatives with the project. Welcome to you, Michael.
It's great to be here.
And we're joined by phone by Victor Talmadge, who's also making his Ubuntu debut in the role of James Tyrone. You may have seen him recently in the production of The Good Person of Sichuan at Cal Shakes. He's also trod the boards at Center Rep, Z Below, Berkeley Rep, ACT, Theater Works, et cetera, here in the Bay Area especially. He's also worked extensively in New York and regional theaters and was on Broadway in the world premiere of David Mamet's November. Was the titular King in the Broadway national tour of The King and I, and was seen as Scar in the L.A. production of The Lion Kings. His talents also extend to film, TV, playwriting as well, and through the magic of radio, we have him now with us. Hi, Victor.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And say hello to Kathleen and Michael while you're here.
Kathleen, Michael, it's good to hear from you, and look forward to seeing you later today.
All right. Hello, Victor.
Well, Michael, let's start with you with a little bit about the background of Ubuntu and how you're presenting these works in a changed way for a contemporary audience.
Yeah, I mean, the background of the company, I actually founded it while I was in graduate school at UC San Diego, and we would bring classmates of mine up to the Bay Area, and we put on festivals in the summer and partner with Laney College and other local actors. And then 2016, we sort of launched the season, a year-round season. So we've been going now for about 3 years. And the mission is to inspire compassion across socioeconomic and racial barriers and to see if theater is a means by which we can bring a divided community together, a segregated community together, and shared compassion and experiences. We choose American classics as at least one facet of what we do, in part because in many ways I think those classics speak to the genesis of where we are today. I think there can be deep wisdom in either O'Neill or Arthur Miller or Tennessee Williams or August Wilson, and trying to unearth that and see, well, what's happened? How have we arrived at whatever crisis or whatever challenge we're facing now? And one of the ways that we do that, I think, is both aesthetically and I think in terms of casting. Like, so, for example, Long Day's Journey into Night, one aspect is that this literally might not look like a family, but I think poetically it's going to feel like an American family. And how is it that the suspension of disbelief that's inherent in the theater can allow us to sort of see our larger selves as a larger community on stage?
Tell us what Ubuntu, the Zulu proverb, means.
Yeah, it means I am because we are, or my humanity is tied to yours. And we try and exemplify that value in every level of our organization. Both from our staff to our audience to who's on our stage, and that's kind of the value we try and inspire in our work.
Mm-hmm. Long Day's Journey into Night is considered O'Neill's magnum opus, one of the finest plays of the 20th century. When it opened on Broadway in 1956, won the Tony Award for Best Play. He posthumously received the 1957 Pulitzer for the drama. The play takes place on a single day from 8:30 in the morning until midnight in August of 1912. Let's hear a little bit more about the plot of Long Day's Journey into Night for those that have not picked it up since high school or haven't caught a recent production of it.
Yeah, it's a Long Day's Journey into Night. it's an epic. I mean, it takes place in the course of the day, but
semi-autobiographical.
Yeah, and you know, part of what we're exploring with the piece is setting it. I mean, Eugene O'Neill wrote it about his family, and I think in many ways was sort of exorcising the demons and the haunts of his family. And so we're setting it in that way in a theatrical stylization of kind of a memory piece. And how is it that we all have these aspects of our family in our own memories, and that we're constantly trying to wrestle with our own past, trying to exorcise those demons to somehow emerge from them.
Mm.
The piece itself is sort of written in the style of when he wrote it in around the 1940s, 50s, of a realism. But Eugene O'Neill also was notorious before his later works in being experimental. And so that's something we're also kind of playing with, is what's the theatrical version of this play, and how is this classic kind of a mythic version of our own collective American memory.
Hmm. Since we have a couple of the actors with us, why don't we talk about the demons they are carrying and perhaps exorcising throughout the production. Kathleen Ridley, tell us about Mary Tyrone.
Mary Tyrone is a loving wife and mother, primarily. I think that that's most important. I think that what gets brought out about her often is the fact that throughout this play, she has this morphine addiction and has throughout, since the birth of Edmund, her 24-year-old child, due to the struggles after giving birth to him. But I think more than anything, she's always reaching for love and connection in her family, but she struggles internally with the pain of having been addicted to morphine and having that call to her whenever stress gets too much for her, whenever she's concerned about her son being very ill, and it calls to her in the same way that we see today the epidemic of opioids now calling to people to go into a haze, to go into a place where they feel a peace or they feel a freedom or something because of the struggles that we live with in everyday life. And I think that I'm thrilled to have the opportunity to play this role, but of course I carry her around in my head all day every day, which when we're done with this, I will happily say goodbye to her with love in my heart, because it's a lot. But yeah. I do love the opportunity to play this role and to really examine and get into who she is as a loving human being throughout her struggle through the play.
And so what is her particular journey in the long journey into the night?
The long journey for her is starting out the play and resisting as much as she can the need for morphine in order to dull the pain that she's experiencing. And as she goes through the day, sort of dipping into that, getting more involved in that, resisting it, and then the demons of the past come up to her, the child that she lost, Eugene, before she had her son Edmund, the struggles with her son Jamie, who's becoming an alcoholic, and just all of the demons from the past come back to her and haunt her as she goes through this day and as she fights, struggles against, and struggles with this other character in the play, which is morphine.
Fascinating. Victor Talmadge, you're in the role of James Tyrone, and a veteran actor playing a veteran actor. Tell us a little bit about James.
As you say, he's a successful commercial actor, and in the not so much the twilight of his years, but the autumn of his years, and he is facing a crisis. The crisis is that his family is coming apart at the seams, and his younger son has a chronic illness and a possible fatal illness, and he's facing the reality of losing what he loves, and that reality is forcing him to face his own demons, and his own demons are about selling out his talent, giving up his ability to choose for the sake of security, which I think is an all too common theme these days anyway. One of the things that I do want to stress is that, and this is something that I really appreciate with our production and it's Michael's vision, is that this is as much a celebration of life as it is anything else. This is not the typical dour kind of downbeat production, in the sense that our characters in this play are all reaching out to each other to try and resuscitate them. We're not beginning a dirge into the depths and then continuing down. We're really trying to actively generate a connection between each other. And I think that gives the play, at least our production, a vibrancy, which I haven't heard or seen of in prior productions.
Nice. And Michael, let's talk a little bit about that, your interpretation then of this and bringing it into a contemporary role. We mentioned the contemporary opioid crisis, and just every family has crises. And so how are we bringing, are you bringing the setting up to a modern setting, or are you keeping it in the 1940s, 50s?
We're keeping it in the past, but hopefully in the way that we're rendering it, it will feel like the past of our contemporary moment in some way. And so therefore, I mean, a major theme of the play is how the past is present and it's the future too. I think Mary has that line. And so it's the cycle that goes on and on and on. So we're not literally setting it in any kind of contemporary setting, but I think that the energy of the production will have the feeling and urgency in some ways of a contemporary production. And I am very excited about sort of what Victor mentioned, which this notion that the characters are fighting desperately for love and for each other and for life. And it's the misplacing of where you get that sense of life that comes through. That is something that, you know, is the challenge of the piece in many ways. I think that often just the weight of the piece and frankly the length of the piece can feel so heavy. And this is something that we're trying to activate and also find in each character how they want to live. I think that's what's inspiring about the work.
I would like to just interject that we have trimmed it down a bit, so it's not the standard long running time.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what it comes in at, Michael, but. Michael would know better, but it comes in
at the perfect time.
There you go.
We should also give a shout out to the other actors in the ensemble, Jose Rodriguez playing Jamie Tyrone and Kevin Ribbleton as Edmund Tyrone. You have a Alexandra Court as someone in the ensemble as well as playing cello. So is that the soundtrack of the show, so to speak, the sound design?
Yeah, it'll underscore the entire production, and there'll be some melodic elements and also some unconventional elements as well to kind of give a sense of being on edge. And that's the other element in the play that we're exploring, is this urgency that happens in a family when addiction infiltrates and how everyone is constantly on edge, and there's a stimulation to that. There's an adrenaline to that. And you know, in that way, it allows us to pick up the pace of the show, too.
So. Right.
I also find it interesting that for me, for Mary Tyrone, the cello is actually my scene partner in one of the points in the play. That it's usually a person, a character called Kathleen in the play, but the sound of the cello is what Mary is responding to in sort of this dreamy state, and the visions that she's having and the conversations that she's having are as much with herself and with sort of the ghosts of the past and the present, but it's represented through this cello music, which is really a beautiful thing for me to experience.
Wow, lovely.
And we have some wonderful movement choreography by Katie Faulkner.
Yes.
Who's also underscoring the whole vision of Michael.
That's Victor Talmadge as the role of James Tyrone, Kathleen Ridley as Mary Tyrone, here with artistic director Michael Morin. Long Day's Journey Into Night is in preview on October 4th and 5th. Opening night is the 6th. And as always, Ubuntu Theater is a pay what you can at the door for every performance. UbuntuTheaterProject.com for more information. And we perhaps will have them on again in a couple of months to talk about the play Mahabharata world premiere. Thank you all for coming in today.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much.
Still to come, regular contributor Peter Robinson will be talking about the Ken Burns documentary series on country music and give us a preview of the Marin Film Festival, and now it's 42nd year. Next, I talked recently with the cellist Oliver Herbert, and he's playing music of Haydn. Here's a touch of Haydn to introduce us here. There we go. Haydn. Ah. Haydn being performed on a cello made in 1869, a Guagnini. Thank you. music of Haydn being performed on a cello made in 1869, the young cellist Oliver Herbert. He's back as guest soloist in familiar stomping grounds, as you'll hear shortly, performing on this week's San Francisco Symphony Concerts, Haydn's Concerto No. 2 for cello and orchestra, MTT on the podium for a concert that is predominantly music of Stravinsky, pairing the classical and neoclassical. The superb San Francisco Symphony Chorus joins the orchestra in Stravinsky's kaleidoscopic three-movement choral masterpiece, Symphony of Psalms, and tenor Nicholas Fan and baritone Tyler Duncan featured in his Canticum Sanctum with the symphony in three movements, rounding out the program, presented tonight, Friday, and Saturday at 8 p.m. I caught up with cellist Oliver Herbert earlier this week at Davie Symphony Hall. Welcome to Open Air.
Thank you.
You're just back from some chamber performances in Switzerland, I understand.
Yes, I was there for about a week in a small town called Corona, which is on the outskirts of Lugano. Really beautiful place. Yeah.
What sort of repertoire did you play?
Well, we played Beethoven Piano Trio, Opus 70 No. 2, CPE Bach Trio, as well as Dvorak Quintet, Weinberg Piano Quintet. Two programs, and it was a lot of fun because we all lived together in this one house for a week, and so we had a lot of time to cook and rehearse, and it ended up being a really amazing experience with lots of new friends.
And I'm sure a beautiful setting as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, as a young performer, every concert experience must carry a certain amount of excitement and surprise. Is there a favorite place that you've made music that you want to go back to? As a former member of the youth orchestra here, you've probably experienced a lot of halls around the world.
Yeah, well, actually, I must say that this is probably the most special place for me to play. I guess it's fitting to say that right now, but I really grew up around this hall and around this orchestra, and so to be back here and to play here is always, I think, the most meaningful in a way for me.
The cello repertoire is so rich, from the iconic Tchaikovsky and Dvorak concertos, Elgar, two of those I see on your schedule in the months ahead. What are you most looking forward to down the road, and do you have a favorite among those iconic ones?
Well, I think for me, all of these different pieces, whether they're the iconic concertos or the lesser known ones, they all offer something really unique. So in a way, it's really hard for me to pick a favorite. And actually yesterday I was sitting on the plane and listening to some Rachmaninoff, and I thought to myself that this is just the best music that has ever been written. It was so moving. Like, I was, you know, crying on the plane, being ridiculous. And then and I have that very similar reaction to Beethoven, for instance, or, you know, many, many other composers, but it's always expressed in a very different way. So, you know, these great musical minds, they always have something to offer, very specific, or touch a certain part of who I am when I'm listening. And so I think when I choose my repertoire, and one of the things that makes me really excited is to explore all these different areas of different composers and different expressions, different time periods, because they all have something profound and meaningful to say that kind of, I think, deserves to come alive right now, whether it was written, you know, today or 400 years ago.
As a younger player, do you feel it's easier to get in your ear and your fingers works by contemporary composers, like I see Kaija Saariaho on your repertoire list, and perhaps you'll be working on Mason Bates' concerto down the road?
Yeah, well, I haven't played Mason's piece yet, but I would absolutely love to. And I think with the contemporary pieces, I tend to, when I'm studying, approach it in a very similar way that I would, for instance, approach the Haydn, just really taking very seriously what the messages on the score that the composers have given, and interpreting all those messages to try to get inside the head of the composer and inside the heart, and One of the benefits, of course, with living composers is that we can ask them. So that's always very exciting. But in general, I don't actually feel like, for me at least, there's too much difference between approaching a new piece and an old piece.
Speaking of old and new pieces, the Haydn Concerto No. 2 is being plopped in the middle of a program of Stravinsky. That's kind of unusual.
Yeah, well, I think that the Haydn has a certain structural clarity and this kind of optimism and lightness and exuberance that pairs really well with the rest of the program. And certainly Stravinsky was also very inspired by this classical model and his compositions. And I think also the emotional content of the piece both complements certain other Stravinsky pieces in the program and juxtaposes them in the perfect way. So I think the program will be will come together very nicely.
And then you're also going to be involved in this Sunday's San Francisco Symphony Chamber Concert. What will you be performing then?
Yeah, I'll be playing the Dvorak Sextet for strings. So it's two violins, two violas, and two cellos. And I'm very happy that I actually suggested this piece and the symphony musicians agreed to do it. One of whom is my former teacher from my childhood, Peter Weirich. So that's really exciting to be able to play with him. That was one of the things I was thinking about also with his instrumentation. Six players is a large ensemble, and I definitely wanted to play with as many people as possible, especially because it's just one concert on the 29th. Mm-hmm. So it's a beautiful piece by Dvorak, not heard very often, has a certain pastoral quality to it, and just very beautiful folksy work.
Let's talk a little bit about your instrument that you're playing. I understand it's a 1769 Guadagnini cello that would belong to the Italian cellist and conductor Antonio Yanigro, on loan from the family. How does that work?
Yeah, well, I was very fortunate to meet actually the son of Antonio Yanigro. His name is Damir, and he's a neuroscientist in Cleveland. And I was playing in a chamber music festival that I go to every year. And one day, you know, I knew, because I knew of his father, and I knew of this great cellist, of course. And so we always had a lot of interesting conversations. I would ask him about his, you know, dinners as a child with all these famous musicians coming over. And one day he says, oh, would you like to come over? And I actually have this cello at my house. And I had no idea it was this cello that had been played by his father and, for instance, recorded concertos with the Chicago Symphony and, you know, so on and so on. And I show up and I play it. And basically he told me that his father always wanted the cello to go on to young people that are developing their careers in order to help them get to the next step, because it's such an essential part. Having a good instrument is really, really important. So I got incredibly lucky, right place at the right time, and a big thank you to the family for allowing me to play on it.
What is it so special about this cello? Is it the upper register, the lower register, or what?
Well, and speaking of the registers, I think are very even, which is a very unusual characteristic for a cello. So it has this certain quality that carries all throughout the registers. And I also love this instrument because, in a way, it's not the most powerful cello in terms of the decibel levels, like loudness, but it has a certain quality to the sound and the overtones and the ringing quality that I think really works well in a hall. And it has the kind of sound that I think draws listeners in as opposed to projects out into your face, which I think for certain repertoire, especially like the Haydn, is a really something that you can really play with. It has an extremely malleable characteristic that I can always kind of shape phrases in a very subtle way, and it responds and is always giving feedback. And I think in a lot of ways I've learned a lot from this instrument. And whenever I learn, for instance, a new piece, it's always very humbly because I think to myself, wow, this cello knows this piece much better than I do. So it's always a funny feeling. Yeah.
Well, it's funny you should say that because I did a little bit of research and I found a fascinating coincidence about this. You mentioned that the cello itself belonged to Antonio Yanigro and you're getting it from the family. Mario Brunello, who was a student of Yanigro, was the last soloist to perform the Haydn Cello Concerto No. 2 here with the San Francisco Symphony back in 2011 with Tan Kupan conducting.
That's amazing.
I see you're going off to Caramore and Cotona, New York in early November. And you'll be back this way February with Donata Cabrero and the California Symphony. We discussed some of Donata's repertoire last week on that show. And then I see another wonderful connection with a good friend and great maestro Alistair Neal in his new role as conductor of the New Haven Symphony next March, where you're going to be doing one of those iconic concertos, the Dvorak.
Yeah, that's right. And it's just amazing, this Bay Area music community, and whether it be Donato or Alistair, the symphony. I'm feel like there have been a lot of ongoing musical relationships that have especially come out of the fact that I was in the youth orchestra and happened to be able to have access to these incredible musicians. And so I think I kind of, you know, I always feel very grateful for the youth orchestra in particular for kind of giving me access to that world. And of course, also Michael Tilson Thomas, who has been an incredible inspiration and support for me and has given me a lot of my first real opportunities in certain areas, whether it be the fun collaboration that we did at the Soundbox with the Debussy Cello Sonata, or coming and working at New World Symphony, or last year with the All SF concerts at the San Francisco Symphony. All of these things have been incredibly meaningful, and couldn't be happier to work with him again.
And to be a part of his final year as a music director.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a very exciting season, and very happy to be a part of it.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much for sharing some time today. We look forward to hearing both the cello and the cellist for the Haydn Concerto No. 2.
Thank you.
Part of the second cello concerto of Haydn, presented over these next 3 evenings, 8 p.m., Davies Symphony Hall. Soloist Oliver Herbert on the podium, Michael T.T. on the podium for a program of classical and neoclassical music, the latter composer Igor Stravinsky, and for more information, sfsymphony.org.
The only two things in life that make it worth living is guitars tuned good and firm feeling women. I don't need my name in the marquee lights. I got my song and I got you with me tonight. Maybe it's time we got back to the basics of love. Let's go to Lookingback, Texas. Waylon and Willie and the boys.
It's not often that we pair Franz Josef Haydn with Waylon Jennings, but for this next segment, here's Peter Robinson to tell us why.
Hi, David. Yes, good to be here. And we have the jump from a very melodic Haydn, I might add, to here we go. It's Waylon Jennings and the boys. The boys, of course, are Willie Nelson, Chris Christopherson, Johnny Cash. And they are part of this excellent series, which has just finished, the PBS docu-series on country music, which is a classic Ken Burns production. And it's run over the last week. There's 8 two-hour segments, but it is available now on a DVD set. And I think if you want a overview of what country western music has meant in this country, and I think I want to say in the world as well. This is the exact vehicle to learn more about it. So we start off at the beginning of the 20th century. We actually finish also at the end of the 20th century. Probably the last year is 1996. And you're going to hear everything from the hollers to the honky-tonk to pop and everything in between. Because one point that Ken Burns makes is not only the flexibility of country music, but the way it changes and evolves over the years. And the documentary is very much rooted in the story of the recording industry. And I'm certainly in that age group that remembers the old 78s. It moved to 45s. It turned into LPs. It went on to cassette. It finally got to CDs. And then nowadays, we don't have records anymore. We go direct and get it differently.
You missed the 8-tracks, Peter.
I'm 8-track. I missed 8-track. That was when I was asleep in my car, still tapping out. So I think what Ken Burns has done is to condense many different genres, because country music is not simply Nashville, it's not simply Tennessee. And I think the distinctions he makes between the Bakersfield sound, the Texas sound, and then you throw in a lot of religious hymns, almost church-type music, which was then converted into country. And you also learn about the instruments, how the European influence may have brought the violin, which of course we want to call the fiddle, how African-American introduced the banjo and the use of plucking in the background music, and of course drums as well. And then you've got the melodies, which in some cases are English, Irish, Scottish ballads, to the Appalachian sound. So you have a lot to cover, but at the root of this are old Western cowboy songs from south of the Mason-Dixon line, and that seems to be an ongoing recurrence. And then, of course, come the names, Jimmy Rogers, Hank Williams, Dolly Parton, the list goes on. And I particularly like the respect they paid to poetry. I've often found much poetry in the ballads of country western, and they give due respect to Kris Kristofferson, not only a performer and a singer, but also a songwriter. To me, Bobby McGee, particularly when it's sung by Janis Joplin, is great poetry put together with a great voice. So if you're interested in how country western evolved, the sadness, the soul, the marriages, the breakups, the alcoholism, the drug addiction, and of course redemption, they all come together in this kind of historic format, which I think is really a history of America in the 20th century. And you see the evolution of sound, and of course, above all, how the Grand Ole Opry and Nashville came to play a key part. Now, the series is available on PBS documentary. It's on DVD. So if you missed last week and you're still looking for some toe-tapping music as you're driving across the city, or if you want to go home and put it on, it will take you on a journey which I think is really well put together. And of course, you've got some of the classics of Ken Burns. You've got the faded black and white photography. You've got that narration by Peter Coyote, which gives a sort of sense of sternness, but let's get a move on at the same time. And of course, above all, you've got the music. So maybe the circle should be unbroken. And we'll see how that sounds now.
There's a bitter home awaiting in the sky, Lord, in the sky. Undertaker, Undertaker, please drive slow.
Kind of
circle be unbroken, the Carter family classic recording, made a part of the classic, soon to be classic, Ken Burns series on country music.
So now we're going to move on. We're back home here. We've left Nashville behind, and we're down, deep down, deep down in the town of Mill Valley. And starting next week on October the 3rd is the Mill Valley Film Festival. This is the 42nd year, so Mill Valley has become a regular feature when it comes to screening different stars of different movies. And in this upcoming series, we've got 12 world premieres, we've got 11 North American premieres, and also to mention at the Mill Valley Film Festival are special events, including events at Sweetwater, another, I want to say country western home, but a general home for all types of music. The program opens with a movie called Just Mercy, and it is, again, one of those southern stories set in what I call very much Harper Lee country, the story of an African-American put on trial for killing a white woman in 1988. And you kind of feel that we're going through sad but well-trodden territory. So this is what opens at the Mill Valley Film Festival, and Jamie Foxx will be there to both speak about the film and give us some insights on the background. Now, the festival runs for almost 2 weeks. It closes with another interesting true story. It's called Ford versus Ferrari. It starts Matt Damon and Christian Bale and tells the story of how both a designer and a race car driver take on the corporations in an interesting story. Now, during the different weeks, I've highlighted a couple of things that I myself would be interested in. We've just been talking about the Grand Ole Opry, and October the 4th at the Mill Valley Film Festival, they are doing a documentary called The Gift. It's the Johnny Cash story, and this will be screened at the Sequoia at 5:30. So if you feel you want to get a little extra insight that you haven't already had, then Johnny Cash is back on the scene again. October the 8th, something, again, I happen to have a special interest in. It's called 63 Up, and it's a very interesting story directed by Michael Apted, of which these group of seven-year-old British school children have had every 10 years their history traced, and we've now got up to the year 63. So that's why it's called 63 Up. It's a story of how a group have now reached a retirement age and how their different lives have evolved. The advantage, I think, of going, you get a good cross-section of different cinemas in Marin, because these are screened at Larkspur, they're screened in downtown Mill Valley, and in San Rafael at the Christopher Smith Classic screening house, which, of course, is the home of this festival. So there is plenty to choose from. It runs from October 3 until October 13, and you do get the chance to see films which may not make it on the general circuit because they have documentaries, they have specialised interviews, they have lots of different musical venues. In fact, it's for movie buffs and anybody who enjoys live theatre and screenings. So that is the Mill Valley Film Festival starting next week on October the 3rd.
Thank you, Peter, and we'll have links to the festival at our website, kalw.org.
Thank you, David. Good to be here.
Of course. Well, today marks the 50th anniversary of the release of the Beatles' Abbey Road album. Come Together, Something, Maxwell's Silver Hammer, Octopus's Garden, Here Comes the Sun. Tonight, in celebration, under the auspices of Classical Revolution, you can hear Abbey Bode at the Chapel, 777 Valencia Street. Led by Chicago-based violinist Sam Sharp, who created new string quartet arrangements of all the tracks from the album, over 120 pages of string quartet music, Abbey Bode is made up of Sharp and Cherith Premowardana on violins, with Berkeley native Becca Wilcox and Viol on viola, and Nora Barton on cello. I talked with my good friend Cherith this past Sunday evening when I was guest host for Revolutions Per Minute. You can hear that conversation through the KALW local music player at kalw.org. That's also where you'll have a chance to listen to this archive program and any open-air program in the past. My thanks to Neil Swinkels for producing the show. I'm David LaTulipe. Thanks so much for listening. By the way, here's Abby Bode performing Something for that concert tonight at the chapel. Go to classicalrevolution.org.